So last week we started a new study on words fitly spoken. And we began by emphasizing the power of words. And of course, the best demonstration of the power of words would be God. He spoke everything into existence by words. And then he continues to be powerful in his word because his word can transform our lives. And then we talked about the fact that it's an aspect of humanity. It's a gift that he's given humanity, and it's something that's in his image. The being able to communicate, to use our words. Proverbs 18:21 tells us that there's power in our words, not that we can create things like God did, but we have the power of life and death, and that's what we started our study with. Then we looked at Jesus' words in Matthew 12:36, that due to the power of our words, that there is responsibility and accountability attached to that, and how we use our words. And there's going to be a reckoning. There's going to be judgment based on the words that we have used and how we have used them. Our theme for the whole study is taken from Proverbs 25:11. And that just indicates saying the right thing at the right time, with the right attitude, the right intent, and that whether it's used poorly or fittingly, that there is value to both of those, because they can either be encouraging or building up, or they can be destructive. And Jesus identified the source of our words, and also in Matthew 12, that it's just like water drawn from a well, that our words are drawn from our hearts. And so the condition of our hearts will make manifest in our words, in the ways we use them. And then we looked at communication, which is an important aspect of our words, the information electronic age that we live in. And I think there was a consensus that some things have improved, but then a lot of things have not, even though we live in a fast-paced world of communication. And just like any tool, it can be used for good or it can be abused and used poorly. Towards the end of class, we were dealing with one thing that electronic communication is lacking, is empathy. And so we talked about the importance of sympathy and empathy and the fact that those are not synonyms, that they have two very different meanings. That empathy is a deeper level of feeling. It's an experiential level where the euphemism we would use is you walk in someone else's shoes. Sympathy is I feel for you. Empathy is I feel with you. So both are very important. We weren't minimizing either one. It's just two different levels of feeling or our understanding with someone else. And those are both very important because we're told in Galatians 6 that we're supposed to bear one another's burdens, as well as weep when someone weeps and rejoice when someone rejoices. And so that action of humanity is, it's one-on-one, it's very personal, it's warm interaction that's often lacking in the electronic age, was our point. And so that brought us down to question 5, which is up here on the board. And I ask, what attitude must we have in order to speak beneficial words to others? And I cited Philippians 2, 3, and 4. Humility, exactly. Love for God, love for others are both accomplished in humility. And they're both foundational precepts of God, aren't they? Pretty much across all the dispensations. Jesus said it was central to the law of Moses, and of course it's central in the Christ kingdom as well. The priority is always to put God first, then to put others before yourself. And in fact, I think you could probably sum this whole class up. I mean, Jesus summed up the whole law. He distilled it into love God and love others. And we could do the same thing. Love God, love others, and think before you speak. And so the whole passage, the passage I cited there in Philippians 2, starting in verse 3, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. And of course, then Paul goes on following that passage with the perfect example for that, which is who? Jesus, exactly. He left heaven to come to earth. He came in the flesh. He experienced life in every way we do, and that means in a general sense. That doesn't mean he was ever in a car accident. He never lost a wife. But he's experienced life in every way we have, so that he can sympathize and empathize with us. Hebrews 4, verse 15 says, "For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin." And it's interesting, in the New International Version, they say empathize there instead of sympathize. There's nothing that you can experience in this life or will experience that Jesus can't relate to or sympathize with. And that's why he's our support. He's why the support and comfort for us in times of trouble. So we have to be humble. And this goes into something, again, talking about sympathy and empathy, but how that's very important and very necessary, but it can also go too far. Even those can be abused, even though our intentions may be totally in the right place. And I have an example. I read a book by Celeste Headlee. The book's name is We Need to Talk. In fact, Eric posted this a few months ago. And I said, please don't post stuff that I'm going to use in class. It's even when we're empathizing, we need to think. There's that other element. We have to think before we speak. And I'll just read her account. She said, "A good friend lost her dad. I found her sitting alone on a bench outside the workplace, just staring at the horizon. She was distraught, and I didn't know what to say to her. I started talking about how I grew up without a dad. My dad had died in an accident when I was 9 months old. I'd always mourned his loss, even though I didn't know him. I wanted her to feel she wasn't alone, that I'd been through something similar and understood how she felt. After saying that, she snapped and said, 'You win. You never had a dad, and at least I had one for 30 years. You had it worse. I guess I shouldn't be so upset that mine just died.' So I tried to explain that I knew how she felt, and she insisted I had no idea how she felt. I was sincere in trying to help, but failed to see what I was actually doing. She was sharing her raw emotions. It made me feel uncomfortable, and I didn't know what to say. So I defaulted to what made me comfortable, myself. I may have been trying to empathize, but what I really did was draw focus away from her anguish and turn the attention to me. She wanted to talk about her father, the kind of man he was, to share cherished memories, so I could appreciate fully the magnitude of her loss. Instead, I interrupted her to tell my story." I've done this. Talk about walking in someone's shoes. I have done this. I would think we all have at some point. No one ever pointed out to me what I was doing. Again, the best intentions, but it wasn't helping. It didn't help. And it was drawing focus in the wrong place. And since I read her book and this particular incident, I've had several situations where I've started to say, "Oh yeah, I know what that's like." You know, you can just feel the pride come up. "Oh yeah, I've experienced that. It's like you can't get one over on me. I can up that." And I've remembered this, so it's helped me so far. You know, to stop and think. What I'm going to say, is it going to help her or help the other person, or am I just promoting myself? Have anybody been in that situation? You know, the problem was, and she said it twice in here, "I didn't know what to say." And that's what makes us uncomfortable. We don't know what to say. You know, at times like that, just keep your mouth shut and give somebody a hug or hold their hand or something. Sociologists have actually labeled this behavior, and it's called Phelan. You remember what it is? You answered Eric's post when he posted this. Conversational narcissism. Conversational narcissism, yeah. You remember who Narcissus was? He liked to sit by the water and stare at his reflection. He loved himself. And so it's taking over an uncomfortable dialogue and focusing on me. And it's very subtle, and we almost do it unconsciously. I mean, it's just a natural thing to say, oh, yeah, my dad did the same thing. Or, you know, it's just natural. And again, it's, you've got to engage this thing instead of before this. And again, it may be at the best intentions, but just think first. And I think it's, you know, our culture is so self-centered, I think, today. We just put an inordinate amount of emphasis on ourselves. And I think one thing that contributes to that when we're talking about electronics is Facebook. I mean, Facebook, obviously, there's wonderful things you can do with it. There's wonderful things this congregation does. I mean, supporting each other when some trouble comes along and offering prayers, that's a wonderful aspect of it. But you have to admit, it is abused. I mean, just flip through, scroll through. It draws attention to ourselves more than any other thing we have in our hands today, and just feeds our ego. So, it gives us a platform to promote every aspect of our lives. You know, look at me, look what I'm doing, look where I'm going, look what I'm eating. Listen to what I think. And then we have instant gratification from it because you get those little likes. Again, it can be useful, but you have to admit it's abused. And if we are aware of that tendency to be self-centered in all the ways we communicate with people, you know, perhaps we'll make a conscious effort to listen more and talk less in certain situations. And again, in Hedley's story, it's because she didn't know what to say. So she went on in her book, there's two kinds of responses to consider. And I think if we're aware of these, it might help. One is... One is called the shift response. That's where it brings it back to you. You take a situation, you bring it back to yourself. The other one is a support response, where you shift the focus to the person you're communicating with. Here's some examples. Your child has a clash with another student at school, gets in a fight. Instead of listening to them, you go into a story about how you had a disagreement with a good friend and how you fell out with someone at school. A coworker gets laid off from work, and you relate how you struggled when you lost your job instead of when you got laid off. Here's an example where it's the support response, and it takes me out of the dialogue. They say, I'm so busy at work. So what's your response? Do you say, me too, I'm totally overwhelmed? Or, why? What all have you got to get done? I need a new car. Me too, mine's in the shop all the time. Or, oh yeah, what kind are you thinking about getting? It just shifts it back to them. The response favors the other person. It demonstrates interest in them and encourages them to keep talking. So again, it's more listening and less interest on yourself. Now, obviously, these aren't absolutes. You can't apply this to every situation in the dialogues we have with each other. But there are times when we do share more and commiserate circumstances more than others. And there are times when that's appropriate, and there's times when it's appreciated, and sometimes it may even be sought, our side of something or our experience. Certainly in support groups, that's encouraged and emphasized, where everyone's supposed to contribute as they're dealing with an issue. And again, there's times when we're asked our opinion of things. But it's important to listen, to be observant and try and think what is going to actually help this person, what's going to help build them up and take me out of the equation. And the point is, we can easily slip into that shift response and put all the emphasis on ourselves. It's someone like Hedley in her book likened it to playing pitch and catch with somebody. You're throwing the ball back and forth. It's no fun when the other person holds the ball. It's no fun when someone takes over the conversation. All of a sudden, you're out of it. It's all about them now. Yeah. Right. So someone said, it's never wrong to not talk about yourself. That's why the mouth shuts and the ears don't. So again, it requires thought. Love of God, love of the other person, and think before you speak. And it takes effort. Steve Yaden, I went down with when his brother was dying. I had to bite my tongue, I don't know how many times, to start talking about my dad. I mean, he was just in the room next door when he died. Whatever I had shared, it wouldn't have helped him. You know, all this came to life just recently with that. Okay, any other comments on that? Anybody disagree with that? Or okay, the next thing I had up is, again, this is for those who weren't here last week, this is all introductory lessons that just covers a lot of little different things, which will probably come up again in our specific topics, but this is kind of a broad spectrum. And this is on babbling. What is babbling? And is it something we should avoid? Right. Right.
I wrote that it's the ability to talk without actually saying anything.
Right. Right. That's a good one.
Mindless chatter.
Okay. Mindless chatter. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Babbling is just going on and on without catching your breath or listening to others.
Right. It's holding the ball. Not throwing it back. Exactly. Yeah, the definition I had was the action or fact of talking rapidly and continuously in a foolish, excited, or incomprehensible way. Yeah.
Go back to the last situation where you're dealing with somebody who's really suffering and you want to tell your side of the story. That can become babbling also because they're not really hearing you.
Right.
Because they're in their own situation. They're suffering.
Right.
They keep talking on and on and on because they may not even hear what you're saying.
Right, exactly.
Be aware.
Yeah, good point. So what about, is it obvious from what the definition, is something we should probably avoid? Any passages in the Bible you can think of? I don't think that was part of the question, so I'll slip that in on you. Okay. Right. Well, Jesus, in Matthew 6:7, Jesus said, when you pray, do not keep on babbling like pagans, for they think they will be heard because of their many words. There's one way to avoid it. Matthew 6:7. Uh-huh. Proverbs 23:29-30. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaining or babbling? Who has wounds without cause, who has redness of eyes, those who linger long over wine. Of course, babbling would be associated with someone who's inebriated. So it's tied, we later on in this lesson we'll deal with complaining, but it's also tied to complaining in some situation.
Kind of the opposite of that, I really like Proverbs 17.
Uh-huh.
Even a fool is kind of wise when he holds his peace, when he shuts his lips, he's considered protected.
Yeah. That's a good one, too. Paul warned Timothy. Do you have one? Did you raise your hand? About Timothy?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Actually, I didn't write down the verse. I just had the comments. So go ahead. Exactly. Right. Yeah, that's the one I had. So obviously it's something that we need to avoid. So good. What would you say to someone who is babbling? Just put your hand over their mouth. Fill the void. Yeah. 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 Just keep conversation simple. I have, you've been with people that you think, I don't think they took a breath, and they talked for almost a solid half hour. Or I thought left faster than it came in. sorry. But anyway, keep conversation simple and eliminate the unnecessary would be helpful in avoiding being a babbler. I know what I was going to say. When you're having a conversation with someone, you're the one talking, and you can tell they're just waiting for you to take a breath so that they can step in. You know, that's the other thing. They're not listening to you. They're thinking about how they're going to come back with something. And that's not a good conversation either. Yeah.
Sometimes I think people need to babble. We had an elderly aunt, and she would call, and she would just go on and on and on. It was sort of like a stream of consciousness that was just flowing everywhere. But she needed to talk.
Right.
So I would just put the phone down.
Yeah. Did she live alone?
Sometimes you need to listen to other people's babble.
Did she live alone?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a line, and it's kind of hard for me at least to draw that line, but I think that somewhere there is a line between simple babbling and babbling because you need to talk. Like, I know, and sometimes it's the case with me, but I know that a lot of times it's the case with a friend of mine who is just
right.
Obvious.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if I'd put that under babbling. I mean, that's just someone trying to share their burden.
Right. And they have a lot.
Yeah.
So
it's a long list. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. We're not talking absolutes. I'm just talking about how some of these situations can be. And that was my next question, was that why do people babble? And, of course, Charlotte's given us one example. Why else would someone do that? Okay. Yeah, they get nervous. Yeah. What about something we just talked about? An attitude.
Self-centeredness.
Right. Trying to impress. You know, just keep on and on and on. Some people just like, they think their opinion, again, it's a pride thing, think their opinion is it. This is the way it should be, and I'm just going to, I get hopping up on a soapbox, and I'm going to give it to you. And it just, again, that can just escalate and go on and on. Mr. Rogers, remember Mr. Rogers? He said, in times of stress, the best thing we can do for each other is to listen with our ears and our hearts and to be assured that our questions are just as important as our answers. So if we want to be sympathetic or empathetic and supportive, our emphasis will be, I think, on listening. And again, not preparing in our minds what we're going to follow up with. To either try to top them or match them or whatever. And that, of course, leads to our next question, which was, what ability does James say is important when we are engaged in a dialogue? James 1:19. Exactly. Quick to hear. And And what? Yes, right. So words fitly spoken can be a gift, but so can merely listening. We are born making noise. Listening is a skill we have to learn. And hearing is not necessarily listening. Defined, listening is hearing, but also involves what? Exactly. Understanding, retaining, being able to respond helpfully. So there's much more to it than just the sound waves passing over our ear, through our ears. And again, our culture today, I think, affects our ability to listen. It's said that I thought this was amazing. It's said that the average person today is exposed to as much data in a single day as someone in the 15th century encountered in their lifetime. Think that's possible? In 2011, Americans took in 5 times as much information daily as someone in 1986. So we consume information at an incredible rate. And we're bombarded with words and images and videos and links. And when I was at the Courier Journal, I can't remember the year, it's when USA Today started, the new newspaper that was going to be at all the airports. And their whole philosophy was not these long, lengthy stories. It was everything in little chunks so you could read it quickly traveling or an airport. That was their philosophy. But that's the way we consume. I mean, unless you're really an avid reader and sit and read books, you know, the average person, that's how we get information now. It's just these little bullet points, tidbits. The news stories on the news don't go into lengthy exposés unless you go on like Dateline show where it gives more, but just the news is just little tidbits of things. And so I think this carries over into our conversations. And we may struggle to focus with someone who's what they're saying. And as we said, listening involves more than just these handles on the sides of our heads. We listen to the words and their meanings. We observe facial expressions. I think Debbie said something about that last week, that it's not just the words, but you have, you know, it's the whole person. That's that personal contact that you don't get through electronics. Facial expressions, posture tells us things, and we listen for the tone. The electronics don't come across with tone, of a tone of someone's voice. If communications are all done with devices, all those subtle nuances are lost. Have you ever read an email and thought it sounded kind of snarky, kind of smart aleck, or had an attitude about it, and that's not what the person intended? I don't know how many times I've gotten upset with a client and I've written an email responding somehow, and I went back and read, I worried about it. I thought, did I go too far on how I responded? And I go back and read it. I thought, no, you can take that. It didn't go that far. I kind of comfort myself. But again, there's not a font that we can use for sarcasm. You know, you just those things just don't come through in electronics. So James 1:19 says, "Understand this, my beloved brethren, let every man be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to take offense, and to get angry." So what is he saying? Listen, right. Listening can prevent arguments. It can prevent misunderstandings and responses that aren't beneficial or possibly even hurtful. Yeah. Right. Right. Right, exactly. Exactly. And if you're listening, and not, again, not don't fall into where you're just preparing how you can come back, but giving thought to your words, what your next words are going to be, because you're thinking about the other person. Jesus always thought about the other person. It may not have been kind words. Sometimes it was harsh. But he always came back with the right words in response And so it gives you time to consider what you're going to say and how you're going to say it in an appropriate way. Diogenes said, "We have two ears and only one tongue in order that we may hear more and speak less." Okay, anything else on listening? Yes. Right. 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 Exactly. Right, right. Good point. Yeah.
Just kind of a tidbit, I won't add so much to the conversation, but as you talked about how there's a communication breakdown in the written text, if the Apostle Paul, he addresses that in Galatians chapter 4, verse 20, he says, "But I wish I could be present with you now to change my tone, for I am perplexed."
Yeah. Right.
The situation that they were involved in, that's why he wanted to be there so he could blast them.
That's a great one. Yeah, that's a good one. Okay, anything else? Okay, number 8. Read Hebrews 6:11. What should characterize our attitudes so that we have the full assurance of hope to the end? A what? Okay, desire?
Diligence?
Okay. What about your outlook? What kind of outlook do you have to have to be what you all just said?
Positive.
Positive. Right. Exactly. We talked about our heart is where we draw our words from. That's the well from where we draw what we say. I think that's what I titled this section in my notes was thinking positively, based on Hebrews 6:11. If we intend to speak right, we need to make sure that we're thinking right. It's got to come from the source. So as Christians, we're to show a steady growth, to become a more complete and spiritually mature person. And we encounter challenges and hardships that test us, that test our faith, help us develop the perseverance he's talking about. If we stay in ease and comfort, we're going to stay like babies, which Peter addressed. So that maturity requires some effort on our part. And so Hebrews 6:11 says, "And we desire that each one of you show the same diligence so as to realize the full assurance of hope unto the end." The Greek word there for diligence is spode. It's where we get speed. The word speed. It means speed or haste or earnestness or enthusiasm. It's to move on quickly or swiftly, showing diligence. So not just obeying the Lord, but quickly obeying. There's some intensity there. So is that how we would assess our response when we hear what God wants us to do? Are we responding? Are we just responding? Or are we responding quickly with haste? That's the attitude we should have. And in this passage, it's going to be your attitude, so that you're going to make it to the end. You're going to secure that hope that you've been given. And that's going to require a positive attitude. Make sure you're focused on the goal. You have that mindset that you're going to reach it. And Paul told the Philippians to have that attitude that Jesus had. That means, I can accomplish this. With Jesus, I can accomplish this. So how do we stay focused? Good point. Um, And we trust that God's going to do His part. But we have to do our part. We have to, you know, when Jesus raised Lazarus, you know, He asked them to roll away the stone. He was raising someone from the dead. Couldn't He have rolled the stone away? Just, they had to do their part. And we need to do our part. And God, you know, will do His part. We can trust that He'll always do that. And staying focused that we need God's help, that we can't do it alone. And that, of course, that, as Bree said, that comes through His Word, through the constantly instilling that in our hearts, making that well sweet water, and the encouragement from other people, our fellow Christians. If someone has a negative, is always negative, they're always seeing the bad in everything, they complain, they're critical, they're not going to demonstrate that kind of diligence. They're not going to show that positive attitude. They don't have that positive attitude. So there's not going to be any diligence. So are they going to be someone who you would seek out to receive words fitly spoken? No. They're not going to be someone you seek out for help and encouragement. You'll probably be avoided. And they're never going to mature to be that spiritual person that Jesus expects. So a negative mindset is, it's corrosive and it's infectious. So how much effort and self-control does it take to drift into negativity? Not much. Very little. Can you think of an example in the Bible of how negativity affected
Jonah?
Jonah, okay. Right, he was very negative, yeah. Right. Right. And even before the manna, or no, it would be after the manna. What about when they were spying out the land? How did negativity affect that? You know, going from Egypt to Canaan was a couple of weeks. How long did it take them? 40 years. Because of negativity. Right. You know, the 12 were sent out, 10 came back with the negative, 2 had the positive. And look what the effect it had. It was infectious, it spread through the camp, everybody, no, we can't do it. And when you think about it, in our society, bad news is sensational. You know, people crave the bad news. Let's hear what happened today. It attracts interest. And it's the bulk of our news broadcasts and publications. I mean, they always end with some sweet story, but the whole half hour you've seen nothing but murder and mayhem. And I mentioned working at the newspaper. I was there for 11 years. The people that work there, the majority of their time is spent reporting the worst things that happen in humanity. And it wasn't until I was away from there that I realized the atmosphere of cynicism and skepticism and mistrust and suspicion that was there. And it manifested itself in the people. They complained. There was bitterness. There was excessive profanity with people that you're supposed to use words all the time in the news, but excessive profanity, irreverence, thinking the worst of everybody. It's just how that, dealing with negativity all the time, how that affected them in their personal lives and in the workplace. And so once I was away from it, I didn't realize how much I had been complaining until I left. I had been drawn in at least that far. 1 Corinthians 13:7 is talking about love. But look at the positive attitude it promotes. 1 Corinthians 13:7 says, love does what? Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. That's a positive mindset. Proverbs 15:15, all the days of the afflicted are bad, but a cheerful heart has a continual feast. So we need to fill our thinking with God. Let Him work in us. Put effort into combating negative tendencies. We can all so easily slip into it. And we can control our thinking. It's our brain. We can control it. And that's what Paul's thought was in Philippians 2, 12 and 13. So then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure. So we can control it, and God can help us do that. So this brings us to controlling our thoughts, controlling our words. And again, we keep saying Jesus is the best example for that. He always said the right thing at the right time with the appropriate, it was appropriate to the situation. And He knew when to withhold words. It's not just a matter of always saying something. Again, He knew when to withhold. He never talked about His situation in a negative way. I don't think you can find a passage where He did that. He always coupled whatever He was experiencing or enduring with, this is God's will. And He held His silence during negative situations, and that was at the best. And He never gave Satan the opportunity to hinder God's plan and His mission. So the next question, we won't have time, probably not going to go into this one very much. In what situations should we be more cautious about what we say?
When you're upset or angry.
Okay.
When you're negative about something.
Right. Right.
The power of your words. I mean, you could be shaping somebody's reality that day or something. If you just, I think it's wise to always be cautious. Not that we do.
Yeah.
You take the cautious side.
Right.
When you're ignorant of the situation, don't talk about something you don't know.
Oh, right. Oh, okay. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. And pride can kick in there. Oh, yeah, I know. I'll tell you. Yeah.
Piggybacking on that in evangelistic efforts, even when you know the answer, how you present the answer and how you walk people through things, I think we have to be very cautious. I mean, never that we would compromise the truth, but there's a difference between that and stuffing it down somebody's throat to a point where they never want to listen again.
Right. Right. So when we're under pressure, things aren't going bad. As Kim said, you get frustrated and upset or emotional. We can easily slip into foolish talk, inappropriate words. You know, Jesus at His arrest and trial, you know, consider the self-control He demonstrated during that whole thing. Think about how frustrating that would have been. This is the Son of God. And what He had to contend with, those attitudes with those Jewish leaders, and He knew their hearts. He knew how stubborn they were and bent on their attitude. And yet He said very little. And that's what Isaiah said in 53:7. He opened not His mouth. There were times when he held back. You just wonder if we'd been in Jesus' place, would we have held our tongue in that situation? Or would you have complained or become emotional? I might think you just blow up, you know, and just scream in their face. You'd be so frustrated. Lash out somehow. But again, we need to assess the words we use, what attitude we're demonstrating, and how we're using them. Is it a positive or is it a negative? Okay, we're whittling away on the first lesson. We'll pick up there next week. Appreciate all your comments.